You're listening to a podcast from The Rocking Vicar.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to this, the official podcast of The Rocking Vicar. It's the parish council once again. I'm Magnus Shaw, and I wonder, wow, he's the greatest dancer. It's Terence Stigham.
You've clearly seen me on the dance floor where, you know, it's just a wonder to behold.
It's one of the seven wonders.
If you believe that, you believe anything. Hello, Magnus
Hello.
Shaw.
Hello.
Hello, and what a cheerful meteorological atmosphere there is around as we record this.
I've spent most of the week soggy and wet, so I've taken a stand against the climate and refused to leave the house. Of course, I haven't seen a drop of rain all day, but yesterday when I was out and about, just soaking, every bend and turn, yeah.
It's a conspiracy, I feel. when it wasn't raining, you managed to find time to pop out and see the exciting new, described as horror comedy film,
yes.
Cabin in the Woods.
Right. Yeah, yes, I did. Yeah, I don't know if it's horror comedy as such. Yeah, maybe horror irony. Certainly, Mrs. Magnus Shaw came with me, and I assured her, "Oh, it's not horror; it's sort of tongue-in-cheek horror." But she watched most of it from behind the lapels of a coat. She found it quite horrifying enough. So, I wouldn't be, distracted into thinking that it's, it's all great belly laughs. We're talking about Cabin in the Woods. You've got to be really careful because. The whole
no spoilers.
Yeah, exactly. And the whole movie is one big spoiler, really. There is an enormous sort of reveal involved in it, or a twist. And of course, to even hint at it will influence or distract people's enjoyment of going to see it. So, in terms of. Narrative, there's very little I can say.
Well, it's great we're reviewing it then, isn't it? What a great...
Well, I can talk about it in abstract terms, and I can certainly say there is a cabin in the woods.
I can tell you what the tagline is. It's on the posters. I'm looking at it now. The cabin in the woods. You think you know the story.
Oh, okay. Yes. Well, that's as far as you can probably hint towards the to what's going on here. I mean, this is a horror film about horror films, I won't nod towards the narrative any more than that. Quite cleverly, you don't really have to know your horror films inside out to appreciate what the twist is and what's going on. However, if you do have a passing knowledge or even an in-depth knowledge of horror films, it's going to be even more rewarding because there's a lot in there for you to sort of back reference to other films that you've seen. It's laden with irony, but it's actually quite a light-hearted film in that it is it drifts towards pantomime at times, but it's also very intelligent. And in places humorous as well. Like I say, it's ripped through with an ironic spirit and it's very self-referencing. And this is what you'd expect for Joss Whedon, of course, who was behind Buffy the Vampire Slayer on the telly, the resurrection of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, not the original movie. And a lot of that became very self-referencing and ironic to the point where they had, episodes in later seasons, where they had an episode in later season, which was all sung. The cast had been cursed with a mischievous spirit that made them sing, so they sang the entire episode. So Joss Whedon is wanting to play around with genres and what is possible within those genres, and this is no exception. If you're going along to see a straightforward stalk and slash horror film, maybe.
Straightforward.
Well, people do, there's the great fountains of the stalk and slash genre.
Oh my God.
It's
a new world to me. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, you may be a little disappointed. But if you are going to see a take on the horror genre that you've not seen before and one hell of a revelation, then you're going to find it most enjoyable. And it is a breath of fresh air. We've had a tranche over the last, I don't know, 7 or 8 years of what has now become termed torture porn. The Saw movies being perhaps the most intelligent strand of that genre, but there's much the Hostel movies and a movie called Captivity as well, which are perhaps the least intelligent and most depressing titles in that genre. But they are all, extremely heavy going and weigh very hard on your mental facilities because they are, as the genre would suggest, torture porn. They're really, how many different ways can you make your protagonists suffer?
No, please, no more, no.
But I mean, they're just not great movies. I don't have any great moral upset about these kind of films, people, but I would definitely recommend it. You may have seen or read other commentators saying how appalling they found it and what a load of tripe it is. It isn't. It really, really isn't. You might come out thinking, oh, okay, that's left me a bit baffled. I'm not sure what I've seen there. But I doubt you'll come out saying that was rubbish because it's very different, very entertaining, and it's certainly one of the most refreshing films of the year. So I would say Give Cabin in the Woods a go, unless you're a complete wuss like Terrence.
Yes, or Mrs.
Magna Shaw, who is upset by the slightest twitch of a tree in the dead of night.
Yes, I'm the same. I have to say I am a complete namby-pamby. I'm like Walter from Dennis the Menace when it comes to these things. Though, I have to say, it is a hit. It cost $12 million to make, and in its first week, it's taken nearly $22 million in the States.
Fantastic.
So,
deservedly so, because if nothing else, it's trying hard and it is an intelligent concept. And yeah, the States of Hollywood at the moment, that's not to be sniffed out.
Well, from Stalk and Slash, thank you so much, he says, with his head in his hands for that review. Stalk and Slash.
Yeah, that's not come from me. That is a very specific horror genre, yeah.
All right, well, talking of horror, this all started with a friend of mine texted me originally.
Okay.
He was at a Chris Rea gig that was at the Hammersmith Apollo last week. Started with a text, and he was just saying, his text said, this is the most unusual gig I've attended, brackets, in terms of atmosphere. There isn't any. So I said, well, can you send me an email to tell me what this is about? So my friend David, not David Hepworth, another David, went to see Chris Rea at Hammersmith, as I say, and he told me that in his email, this is what he says, throughout the whole set, Chris Rea didn't even acknowledge the audience once, let alone speak. He didn't say one word through the entire evening. And he goes on to say, once or twice he jigged a little bit and smiled, but that was it. He wore an old blue T-shirt and old blue jeans. And at the end of his closing song, he just walked off the stage. We didn't know it was there until the house lights came up. And obviously there was no encore.
No. Okay.
Seriously. And a final paragraph, he says, one positive, unusually there was no merchandise on sale, but I didn't think anyone was in the mood to buy any.
Okay.
Everyone I spoke to felt downhearted and a bit ripped off. He certainly isn't Chris Charisma. good closing line there. But yes, have you ever been to a gig where there has been absolutely no interaction with the audience at all? Apparently, Chris Rea just sort of smiled once or twice, looking in general audience direction, didn't even say thank you, didn't say hello or good night. Never known anything like it.
Yeah, this is a style of performance, isn't it? Yeah, I absolutely have. I'm the Sisters of Mercy. The last time I saw them at Leeds Academy, Andrew Aldrich said nothing at all throughout the whole set. They came on, they did the set, they went off, and very poor they were too. And I say that as a Sisters of Mercy fan. I also remember seeing The Cure on the Pornography Tour at Sheffield University. And I don't recall them saying anything either. Robert Smith might have managed a very weak hello. That's my Robert Smith impression. Hello. After about the third song, and that was probably about it. Now, the difference was the Sisters of Mercy gig was entirely reprehensible and a complete waste of money. I remember enjoying the Cure gig thoroughly because I don't think the lack of interaction was down to any contempt for the audience or disrespect for the people who'd come along. It was part of the Cure shtick. You know, these people were... Yeah, far too ethereal to acknowledge the fact that they were playing a gig. You know, they were far too bound up in high-flown gothic concepts of grey cats and sort of ghostly children, which was what we paid to go and see, wasn't it? So I think, you know, they were creating an atmosphere by their lack of engagement. But obviously, in the case of Chris Rea there, he was doing the opposite. You know, he was killing the atmosphere by his lack of engagement. Of course, Chris Rea's music couldn't be more different from the Cure's, and he plays a sort of warm pop rock blues, doesn't he, which kind of goes with a sort of pubby, chatty bonhomie, doesn't it? So if he's left that behind, then he's perhaps not delivering the full ticket. And
it's perplexing to me because, as you say, he is a sort of bloke rock, isn't he, to a degree?
Exactly, bloke
he's
rock,
sort of, you know, one imagines those Eddie Stobart truck drivers, you know, with their yes. Chris Rea CDs in their player,
that's
you know,
right,
as they
yeah.
go up and down the M1
okay,
there.
Yeah.
That's how I would see Chris Rea, which would, yes, I would imagine, I can see as a sort of art form, as part of their shticks, then some ethereal, aesthetic groups may think it not cool to interact with the audience.
Sure.
But Chris Rea, you would expect that there would be bonhomie, a cheery chat, and so on. But what really bugs me about this is I feel there is a certain arrogance on show here. As we've talked about before, if it's nerves, either get some help to enable you to overcome it, or don't do tours at all.
I find it hard to believe that Chris Rea suffers sort of unmanageable nerves at this point in his career.
You never know. I mean, stage fright or panic attacks, whatever, can hit anybody anytime. But I agree with you.
Mm.
It would seem unlikely that, you know, one would set up a large tour and be bedeviled by such disappointments to the sort of live framework. So if that's not the case, then I just think it shortchanges the audience immeasurably. People should go away from any form of show entertainment with a cheerier step than when they walked in my opinion. And what I can't bear as well, whenever I go to live gigs, which is rarer and rarer these days, is I want the performer, the artist, the star, to act as if he's the performer, the artist, the star, and to entertain me. One thing I can't bear is, you know, we want you all to clap along. And that's always a disaster, isn't it? Because audiences, unfortunately, in a group, have no sense of timing. It all goes terribly wrong. And, you know, it's kind of... type thing going on. And, you know, it's cringeworthy. I hate it when bands invite the audience to sing along or take part in any sort of way like that. It's rather like when comedians start picking on people in the audience. I think, no, you come along and you entertain us.
Well, it's interesting that you say comedians because, you know, Ben Elton, before he, you know, sold his soul right down the river, when he was a credible performer, used to have this opener where he'd say, "Now, I don't want you to worry about audience participation. I don't believe in audience participation. After all, I don't come into your workplace and say, 'Can I have a go on your lathe?' So I don't expect you to take part in the comedy." So
I think it's actually a reasonable point. You know, that's exactly it. It is what we're paying the performer to do. Yes. We're paying, you know, considerably huge sums these days for this entertainment. And so entertain me. And just in case you or anybody was thinking, well, maybe he was having an off night at at Hammersmith, I actually went on to some fan forums today and found that this is becoming a criticism that is running right through his tour. Wow. He was at the Metro Arena in Newcastle earlier in the month, and here's somebody saying, the ending was a bit of a shambles, with many not knowing if the show was over or not. Mm. It took an age for the house lights to come on after the band had left the stage. Mm. Mm. And then somebody else, who, by the way, spells audience, this is somebody from Manchester, spells audience O-R-D-I-A-N-C-E.
You're kidding.
I'm not, but please go and look for the Chris Rea reviews on the ticketmaster.co.uk.
They're very close website. To the sort of audience survey map.
yes, exactly.
Oh, hold on. Chris, hold on. I've got to release an album called Audience Survey Map. If anybody's listening, I've copyrighted that. That's a fantastic name for an album.
A live album.
Yes, Audience Survey Map. Yeah, that's mine. And any big rock stars out there, that's mine, by the way.
So that we heard about Newcastle. This is Manchester. Chris Rea was okay. His voice sounded good and he played well, but unfortunately he didn't give off any enthusiasm to the audience. Mm. With no interaction, he never said a word, and the end just died away and nobody knew what was going on, whether to leave or stay.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, I mean, I know in fairly recent years, he's been a very unwell man, Chris Rea. I mean, he almost lost his life to some appalling innards-eating illness.
Has it affected his ability to be polite?
No, of course it hasn't. No, of course it hasn't. I just crossed my mind that he might not be feeling all that. But in which case, you know, seek some medical attention, postpone your tour and come back when you're feeling better. I'm sure that's not the reason. So I'm just trying to really reach out and think what the reason may be.
I can't either. While you're thinking, the Brighton Centre, unfortunately, Chris Rea never said a word to his fans. Strange, and he's missing something. It just goes on. Manchester, New Theatre, Oxford. Didn't do an encore, just walked off the stage.
Well, I only imagine he sort of misguidedly bidding for some kind of let the music do the talking sort of shtick here, and you know, stripping it back, no sort of show business frills attached. But whether we like it or not, going to a gig is attending a showbiz event, and we want some kind of atmosphere or razzmatazz or intrigue or whatever it is. We want to be touched in some way, and you know, clearly he's not doing it. These are his fans talking, so
they are. Yeah. And there's 33 pages of this. There's 601
Hell's bell.
Fans have written in about this, so really has been misguided.
And how to lose fans and alienate people.
Yeah, very much so. So there's the enigma of Chris Rea, currently on tour, but don't go along.
Yes, I was once at the V Festival, and the hip-hop act Cypress Hill were performing.
Oh, yes.
And spent a lot of their allotted time, if that's not too much of a mangling of words, berating the people at the back, me included, for being at the back and not coming down the front. And, you know, joining in or doing what was required of us down the front, as you might imagine, interspersed with many references to the compound Oedipal noun, you know, UMFs, get the F down here, lazy MFs. And I thought, no, I have my ticket here, which cost me dear. I shall stand exactly where I want, and you will work extremely hard to capture my attention and my goodwill. I have no obligation to come down the front and do anything whatsoever. That's that's for me to choose, for I am the customer. That sticks in my mind, really, that these rather self-important hip-hop stars thought it was somehow a stain on my character that I would not go down to the front of the stage and pay homage to them. And
that's the thing, isn't it? They feel it's their right that you perform, you know, in a particular way for them, when in fact it's completely the reverse. Mm. It's our right to expect an entertainer to entertain.
Yes,
it's as simple as that.
Absolutely. I mean, the lack of encores is no disgrace. As I never cease to go on about, I'm a dedicated fan of the Manic Street Preachers, and they never perform an encore. Indeed, on their website at the moment, it says still James, Nicky, and Sean, and the memory of Richie, and no encores. That's the strapline of their website. So.
Oh, I'm all for it, so long as the show, some people, I think, know and accept that, and I think preferably know about it in advance because it is a completely false, absurd, vintage.
I've written about on the Vicar my loathing of the artificial encore, so that's no disgrace. But whilst you're on the stage, you want to be working. You know, it's your job, and we're your customers. When it's all said and done, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We'll leave Chris Rea to his curmudgeonly tour and move on. But it's always, of course, slightly dangerous in what is a weekly podcast to pick on something that is news and changing by the moment. So it's possible that by the time this podcast is heard, the events may have overtaken our next topic, which is the Grand Prix due to be held on Sunday. Mm. We're Friday afternoon as we record this. It still is Friday, isn't it, Magnus? I think
it almost wasn't. But,
it almost wasn't, yeah. The Formula One Grand Prix due to take place in Bahrain on Sunday. And there's quite a lot of debate going on about whether this Grand Prix should go ahead.
Yeah. It's leading the news today, Friday, almost every bulletin, such is the level of debate. And just before we started recording, I noticed Ed Miliband, Ed Millipede, as his private eye have started to call him, has weighed in with his two penneth worth, never wants to miss a passing bandwagon.
But what does he say? Does he want it to go ahead or not?
No, he's like you with the Chris Rea fan sites. He's perused the internet and
picked up the flow.
Yes, selected the weight of public opinion and gone with that, perhaps. The counter argument from vested interests and others seems to be, we must never let politics interfere with sport. Now, I have no truck with this. The whole nature of politics, whether it's always successful or not, is another matter. But the whole nature of politics is that politics is the organisation and structuring of the society around us, the world around us, and therefore by necessity touches every part. So you wouldn't say, housing and politics should never come together, or health treatments and politics should never come together, or policing and politics should never meet and have anything to do with each other. Why sport would be any different, I have no idea. And of course, sports and politics have a lot in common. They have international reach. They depend on profile. They have stir up enormous emotions and have enormously strong followings. So the fact that the two should become intertwined seems almost inevitable. But that's all, I also think it's just a mealy-mouthed cliche used in order for people to go into countries that have severe difficulties in getting to grips with the appropriate way to treat their population in a dignified and decent way, and to go into those countries and make large sums of money and come away again. And we never object to politics and rock and roll intermingling, and indeed it was the refusal of most, though certainly not all, big rock acts to play Sun City that at least made a public statement, an international public statement, about our distaste for the apartheid regime. Didn't change the apartheid regime.
I was going to say, I thought you were going a bit far there.
Politics had to do that, but it was a strong message that people who were being tempted by enormous amounts of money to go and play a whites-only holiday resort wouldn't do it. And that said a lot. It was part of the much larger momentum and impetus that eventually led to the inevitable downfall of apartheid.
Curiously, though, it didn't affect the career of those who did go and play in Sun City, did it?
I rather wish it had, but it didn't. For me, it was a stain on those performers' credibility. And plenty of performers wouldn't go and play Sun City. And I think this is the same. I think, you can't apply your trade on an international stage without being aware of where that stage has been set up. And the idea that holding a Grand Prix in Bahrain is really very good for Bahrain and is somehow going to... Well, on one hand, they're saying that sports and politics should never mix. And on the other hand, they're saying it's somehow a key that will unlock all the troubles of Bahrain. Well, you can't have it both ways. And I think...
Well, okay. Let me give an opposing
all right.
view.
All right, go. Yeah.
Stand down.
Yeah.
Stand down.
Knock yourself out.
Just for a moment. I think there's always difficulties when we try and unpick the politics of particularly these Middle Eastern states, and particularly where the unrest tends to begin with issues between the Shia and the Sunni population. Let's not pretend we have no idea of the real depth of the roots and what that's all about. You know, we can research it, we can learn about it, but that really is what is at the root of this, and in one or two other countries of the Middle East at the moment where such conflict is going on. Now, you know, there are people, of course, protesting and walking down roads and marches and so on, protesting against the government. But I simply don't believe that we here, sitting in England today in April 2012, have enough knowledge to be sure that the best thing for Bahrain is for King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa to be deposed. I don't see that we've got the wherewithal, knowledge, or right to make that sort of decision. Now, just having said that, I also can't see how running a Grand Prix on Sunday will affect that outcome or the lives of the people of Bahrain one way or the other. The point I'll ask you, and then obviously give you the chance to come back, is you may just as well say, well, let's not run the Chelsea-Liverpool FA Cup final next month, because a lot of people in this country, you may even argue the majority in this country at the moment, are very dissatisfied with the Cameron government. Should we call off the Cup final?
No, well, the Cup final is an event taking part, is a national event taking place in a domestic setting, isn't it? So it's not going into another state to hold an event.
The Olympics, then. We've got the Olympics on in the summer for the whole world coming here. Should we call it off because a lot of people coming from other countries will be from socialist regimes, and they may be very unhappy with things that Mr. Cameron is doing at the moment?
Well, I have absolutely no problem with cancelling the Olympics or the FA Cup final. Absolutely fine by me. What I would say is that I would absolutely say that we should cancel the Olympics if those who wish to protest in Britain at the time of the Olympics about anything that is disturbing them, as is their democratic right, would be met with a hail of gunfire, because it might blot the glossy sheen of the sporting event. And that is my core point about the Bahraini Grand Prix, is that those citizens in Bahrain who wish to use the international focus on their country while the Grand Prix is there to point out their dismay and unhappiness at the regime they find themselves living under are very likely to be met with a hail of live ammunition for the regime's fear that it will taint the sporting event. That, to me, is unforgivable. No sporting event is worth that. And if I thought that the Olympics would attract a similar crackdown on any protesters who may attach themselves to the Olympic event, I would say that we don't deserve to hold the event if we cannot accommodate any valid protests. So, yeah. And like I say, I didn't want the Olympics here anyway. And the FA Cup final is on my radar, not at all. So not the slightest bit concerned about that.
So, right, OK. There is one quote which I felt was most unfortunate, even though I have to say, I'm not fully, as is clear, in agreement with you on what you're saying. But I do feel that this is the most insensitive quote of the last couple of days, mm-hmm. from the Red Bull driver, Sebastian Vettel,
okay.
who's quoted as saying on the BBC today about the security issues and the protests. It's not, this is, right, the next bit is a complete quote. Yeah. It's not a big problem, and I'll be happy once we start testing, because then we can worry about the stuff that really matters. Tire temperatures and cars. I don't think it's that bad. I think it's a lot of hype. End of quote.
Yes. Well,
now that shows, I'm afraid, yes. the foolishness yes. of sports people when they too get involved in giving their view on something they clearly have very little knowledge about.
I'm in agreement there. And of course, you're absolutely right. You know, the situation in Bahrain isn't black and white. It is nuanced. And indeed, my only knowledge of the Sunni and the Shia is that they recorded I've Got You, Babe. And that's
Oh, so did you rehearse that?
No.
Oh, that was off the cut. That's superb. Sunny and Shia. I think you may have just cracked the peace process yeah. for the Middle East.
Yes.
They should just all get together and rather like We Are the World at Live Aid. They could just record I've Got You, Babe, yeah. as the Sunni and Shia.
Yes, exactly.
Absolutely, I can see. I think we should go to Kofi Annan, or whoever's in charge these days.
Yes, well, there's somebody.
Recommend it. Oh, that's a cracker. Brilliant. I love that. I think on that note, superb. earlier this week, I just wanted to get a quick view from you. Is it, earlier this week, there was a kerfuffle. And I know this is a bit of it's died away as the week's gone on, so we won't spend too long on it. But there was a kerfuffle between, initially on Twitter, between media commentator, the popular entertainment commentator, Grace Dent,
yes.
and one of her Twitter followers.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And I felt that she overreacted somewhat, but in discovering that this chap who I think had said that she looked like an abhorrent horse or something, yes. which well, it wasn't very pleasant.
I think,
well,
what he actually said is...
Oh, good, you know what he said.
Yeah, what he actually said was that seeing her on Have I Got News For You
yeah.
reminded him of an ex-girlfriend. So far, so good. Here's the problem.
Yeah.
Here's the problem. When I say girlfriend, I actually mean an abhorrent horse that I once made love to.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
It was a very unpleasant thing to say. And by copying Grace Dent herself into it, it was even more unpleasant.
Well, this was the grand faux pas, wasn't it?
That was the grand faux pas.
When he said, looking at Grace Dent on Have I Got News For You, he made the crucial error of not just writing Grace Dent, but writing at, all one word, Grace Dent.
Ensuring it popped up on her timeline.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, irony of ironies, this guy on his public CV announces himself as a digital evangelist. So
it's
rather interesting how unaware he was of how the subtleties of Twitter come about. But
and then, of course, this young man, because it's then transpired that he's a graduate trainee at a public relations firm that actually represents Grace Dent.
I know. Well, what are the chances? Yeah, yes, what are the chances? I mean, I think we all enjoy a bit of schadenfreude, don't we? I wrote about this incident earlier in the week for a creative industry website that I write for. I pointed out that whilst it's very easy to look at this guy's activities and mock and point and say, you blithering idiot, and indeed he was a blithering idiot, but I thought, really, if we were being honest, isn't this the kind of thing that we've all got the potential to do? I know I have. I've been very close to doing things like this in the past just by being an opinionated gobshite, you know?
Yes, as Nikki Campbell could indeed confirm.
Everything I've ever said about Nikki Campbell has been perfectly fair and above board, I think.
Yeah, okay.
I certainly haven't aligned him with any farmyard creatures.
No personal issues, no. But the bit that troubled me a little bit was, I do understand that this died down and it was written off as a little kerfuffle and everybody's friends again. But initially, Grace Dent said, you know, well, I don't think you'll find it so funny on Monday morning when you find yourself unemployed. And I just thought that, you know, it was quite an overreaction. And what I want to say about Grace Dent is, what a change has become the gal since she became a little bit more well known. When she first came to our attention, pretty much as a commentator on Big Brother,
yes,
she was very unself-regarding and was sort of rather quiet about herself and seemed quite pleased to get the chance to be able to speak on such issues. And I just think it's unfortunate that over the last 2 or 3 years, she seems to have designated herself the queen of Twitter and also feels herself to be rather grander than perhaps she is.
Yeah, obviously our self-confidence grows with the position in the world we find ourselves. I don't think that's entirely fair, because I think really what she was doing was really delivering some instant justice to a guy for being very rude about her and doing it in such a clumsy way that it came to her attention. So she let him dangle on the hook for a while before announcing that she'd no intention of demanding that his job was taken away, and that she was merely being mischievous, as was he. And she was meeting mischief with mischief, and she's since said that she found the whole incident highly amusing and holds no grudge. So I think she was just repaying him in kind in a way that I would have found hard to resist had I been Grace Dent, I must say.
Well, I'm glad anyway that it resolved itself with the fellow not having the rest of his career ruined, or, you know, finding himself signing on at the job saying something foolish.
I tell you what, he's learnt more about PR in one Saturday evening or Friday evening in front of the telly with his phone than he has in the preceding
sure has.
6 months, yeah. Hasn't he, really?
I think he sure has, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
I have to say, I certainly wouldn't be employing him for my PR campaign, you know, next week if I was running one. But hopefully, as you say, he'll learn from it and everybody none the worse for the exchange.
Not at all, but it will be replayed many times on many websites when they list these top 10 Twitter disasters.
Yes, absolutely. Now, on television, over the last, well, sort of 10 days or so, we've watched two programs that link together, through, the star, I suppose, of both, Simon Amstel. He was on, television, just over a week ago, featuring his stand-up show, Do Nothing, and maybe we'll come back to that, but we both watched, last night, Thursday, BBC Two, 10 o'clock p.m., Grandma's House, which was the first in the second season of Stores' show for BBC Two. You're like a real-life Paula Abdul, he was told in the early stages of this. I came at a bit of a disadvantage. You saw the first season.
Yeah.
I didn't.
Yeah.
But what I noticed, and I'd be grateful if you tell me that this is how it always is, I just found awkwardness was the running theme through this show.
Sure.
Reasonable script. Strangely underperformed, I felt, in my view. There was a sort of decent visual, but again, rather awkward gag with a broken chair that got smashed up and then set fire to that belonged to the dead. grandfather. But essentially, I found it awkward by design, awkward viewing, 30 minutes of awkwardness. Mm. Is that the way it's
I think that's very much what it's trying to engender. I think it's written from the part of Simon Amstel that's very uncomfortable with his public persona. I think, in keeping with a lot of people who found themselves well known, part of them would sort of craves anonymity because they're rather it's a very British notion. You don't find many American stars who wish to tone down their well-knownness. But I think Amstel is very English and has this sort of embarrassment about how well-known he is. And that's given rise to a script. And, of course, that he has an awkward feeling inside him about his status, and therefore it makes for an awkward script. But I would say a very, in many ways, a sort of very tender humour that goes with the script. In the his discomfort is very believable. And his uncertainty as to how to best to play out his fame, it seems very genuine. And of course, it's a sort of meta comedy because the first season was the recurring theme was what should he do now he's left, never mind the Buzzcocks, because he is playing Simon Amstel. This series is about the fact that he's been commissioned to write a comedy series about him and his family, which is what we're watching. So it has this sort of meta value to it. But that doesn't become complicated and convoluted. It's just Riley there in the background that we're sort of watching a comedy about a comedy, or watching a comedian playing a comedian. I like it. It's not belly laughs, and it's not intended to be. And it has a sort of an Alan Bennett quality to it, where the way people speak just raises your eyebrows, but the characters, except maybe Amstel himself, are unaware that they're being quite odd and quite strange. But of course, we all view our families as quite odd and quite strange, and so I think we have affection for the stranger members of Amstel's family, because we think, well, yes, my family's certainly no normal than that, no more normal than that. And his mother's on and off boyfriend and their awkwardness. But it is a comedy of awkwardness. But I think it's heartfelt and it's intelligent and it's intriguing to watch. And I like Simon Amstel. I like Simon Amstel. I think he is the sort of acceptable Ricky Gervais, in that there's a lot of tone, same tone of The Office and Extras about Grandma's House, but without this, as we now know, rampant ego waiting to burst out. It's very self-deprecating. It's terrific. I would recommend it.
Let's see if you also liked his stand-up routine. A few days before, part of his tour, which was entitled Do Nothing, where, again, I hadn't seen this before. I'm not even sure I don't watch a great deal of television, as we said that. I'm not sure I'd really seen much of him before, but came across as a very likeable, vulnerable sort of fellow, and his honesty and intelligence in this stand-up routine were quite refreshing. But here's the thing. I didn't think it was funny. Maybe it was appealing in the way visual moments of injury make people laugh, and I was thinking it was a bit like, Charlie Chaplin slipping on a discarded banana skin. Uh-huh. I felt this was the sort of intellectual equivalent of this. I felt I was watching an intimate therapy session,
right,
of a man trying to recapture his teenage years, failing, and only too self-aware that he's a 32-year-old man who still wishes to be 17. Neurosis as entertainment.
Yes, and indeed, that's exactly what it is. And I went to this show, the Do Nothing show. At no point does it bill itself as a stand-up comedy show. It is Simon Amstel's one-man show, so it is a monologue, much more
than... Oh, it's not meant to be funny. Okay, well, that's fair enough.
Well, that's going a bit far to say it's not meant to be funny. Of course, it is, he is a humorist, and it is meant to have elements of humour in it, but he's not a stand-up comic per se. He's a writer and a presenter, and writes one-man shows and goes out and performs them. And it is more, certainly more intended to be a monologue than anything maybe a Jack D or Jimmy Carr would do. I liked it for that. I enjoyed it as a one-man show, a dramatic monologue, and I laughed in places, but I certainly wasn't going to come out disappointed I hadn't laughed more, because that's not what I had come to see. I'd come to see an interesting piece of writing about one man's neuroses, and of course, being a gay Jewish man, he has plenty. I enjoy everything he does, and I see that he has a new one-man show about to take to the road called Numb. And I will go and have a look at that as well, because I like the niche he's carved for himself. He's quite unlike anybody else, and I enjoy his ruminations. And I think they sort of echo with everybody. I think he talks about that side of everybody that moves through the world a bit dismayed and a bit uncertain, and I enjoy that.
Okay. Well, he seems quite happy to be defined by his various neuroses. Well,
yes, he seems to be happy being unhappy.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so time to turn to the pretend iPod.
Oh,
and it's that time once again where we return to the make-believe iPod. And we ask you, Magnus, yes, Shaw, to reveal your choice for this splendid iPod this week.
Well, the record I've chosen this week is, I think most people would agree, is an epic record. And the whole nature of epic records is that they have to be very, very, very good songs. Otherwise, all we are left with is not a very good record that is extremely long. And it's always a band's always taking a gamble releasing a very long record in case. Yeah, obviously they're just extending the pain of a bad record. So, I always admire a band that can do a very long record and make every moment of it enjoyable and not seem as long as it actually is. This is one of those records where not only have they got away with releasing a very long record, that every moment of it is worth the candle. And the record is The Who's Won't Get Fooled Again. Now, I came to The Who quite late. As a dyed-in-the-wool punk rocker, I came to most bands like the Beatles and the Stones and the Kinks very late, because it was, imbued in me to dislike all these acts, and Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin and all the rest of them. So it took me a long time to come round to the notion that whilst it might have been appropriate in the late 70s to be very dismissive of those acts, of course there was a lot of the talent and creativity involved in making their records. And The Who were probably the last in that list of pre-punk bands that I came to accept, and I always sort of had weird notion that I didn't like The Who very much, and I don't know why I thought that. It was just received wisdom that was incorrect, and I think it's probably this record that changed my mind. And I'm almost certainly heard it for the first time properly on the radio, because I wouldn't have obtained any Who records at the time for the reasons I've explained. And fortunately, the first time I heard it, it was the full-length version. So I'm guessing it would have been the BBC late-night radio, because there is a much shorter cut of Won't Get Fooled Again, about 3 minutes long, which seems to kind of ruin it, because it needs that expansive drama that Pete Townsend's so fond of, and which he's done with less success in some of his rock opera stuff. But this is a mini opera in itself, I suppose. But in its opening, you're quite surprised that you're going to listen to a Who record, because the opening is an extended organ figure. And you don't really think of The Who as being a keyboard band at all. But as soon as Daltrey's holler at the beginning and Townsend's guitar kick in, you realise you're going to hear a rock record, and what a rock record it is. Despite his snobbery about other people's rock music, which is a shame, Townsend could write a riff. There's no getting away from it. He was a master of the riff, and Won't Get Fooled Again has got one of the best riffs running through it. And Roger Daltrey, although probably lives in the shadow of Robert Plant, I think he can safely take his place alongside Robert Plant as one of the most powerful rock vocalists we've enjoyed. And so the combination of those two in the record's opening makes you realise you're onto something. But of course, when you have got a record of that length, it allows things to fall away and the spotlight to be turned on different performers in the band and different feelings within the song. You've got time to do that, and this certainly does it. And right in the middle of the record, everything falls away and just leaves us with that keyboard figure from the beginning repeating, and it gives Keith Moon the opportunity to just go a bit mental on the drums.
It does, but yeah.
Of course, if you allow most drummers to go mental on the drums, it's tiresome in the extreme because you get a sort of flurry of heavy metal drum solo. When you allow somebody as skillful as Keith Moon to go mental on the drums, what he doesn't do is as important as what he does do. And, you know, every impact on every snare, on every hi-hat is just calculated superbly. And he builds up the tension before the whole thing comes crashing back in again. The other thing I should mention about Won't Get Fooled Again is it's got a really, really interesting lyric. The Who did many, many, many love songs. This isn't one of them. This is a very political song and a lyric that wouldn't go amiss on a Clash record. It's about cynicism. It's about the notion that we all have a high hope for a new government, or it doesn't refer to governments specifically, so it could be a new management team at work or whatever, but we all have high hopes for people who claim they're going to come in and improve our lot and our worth. And it's just about that bit of disappointment when it always turns out that they're pretty much just like the old lot. And indeed, Roger Daltrey sings right at the end, meet the new boss, same as the old boss. But it's also about the political causes that try to attach themselves to The Who and appeal to Pete Townsend for his patronage, and how when he'd done it in the past, it had turned sour, and he'd ended up with his name attached to something he didn't believe in, and hence the title that said, no, from now on, that's not going to happen. He won't get fooled again, which is a really interesting lyric. And it's quite sort of clashy, quite sort of punky in its bitterness and its cynicism. So combine all those factors and you can't help to have an absolutely superb record. But for anybody who's not that familiar with it, please do listen to the 8.2 minute version from the album Who's Next, because that's the version you need to hear. The single version, it doesn't do it justice. And it's my choice, Won't Get Fooled Again, from The Who.
And Keith Moon's drumming style, memorably described as sounding like someone pushing a load of empty tea chests down a flight of stairs.
Oh, well,
which I think...
Yeah, I mean, they said of John Bonham that his drumming style was like somebody playing two wardrobes with lump hammers, didn't they? And I think that's more... I think that's more accurate than the Keith Moon one, actually, because that sounds like... The tea chest description sounds like his drumming was very erratic and random.
I don't think it was meant as a criticism at all.
His drumming was really, really precise.
Yes.
He sort of plays the drums like a lead instrument, like a lead guitar. He stops and starts and stutters and judders. And he's not like John Bonham, who would lay down this mountainous thud behind the Zeppelin riffs. Keith Moon would weave in and out of Pete Townsend's guitar and Daltrey's vocals, almost like a lead instrument. That's what made him a unique drummer, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
And this was recorded, I should say, 4 months before he died. So it was the last time you can hear that full lineup of The Who on a record. Yeah, yeah.
That is absolutely spot on. Now, every now and then, I return to the work of Tears for Fears, usually in the car, where I can sing along with the band and without troubling too many people. Sowing the Seeds of Love was a major hit all around the world in 1989. Number 2 in Billboard in the USA, number 5 over here in the UK, top 10 in Canada, Ireland, Italy, Holland, Spain, long list all around the globe. And the album from which it came, called The Seeds of Love, cost a huge, at the time, £1 million to make, and they're probably still paying it off today. This was a difficult year or two, 88-89, in the history of Tears for Fears, Roland Orzabal and Kurt Smith, and there's been an overflowing bathful of rumour related to the personal lives of those involved, which we won't mention here. Because lawyers can be very active.
Indeed.
It's very interesting for Tears for Fears historians, though. If you view the video from the same album, the track Advice for the Young at Heart, which is on YouTube, from the same album. It's the only track to feature Kurt Smith on lead vocal as they collapsed as a band here. It doesn't take a body language specialist to pick up on the signs of anger and disillusionment, even picked up in the video for this. And they didn't make another video together for 15 years. So clearly there was something going on. However, back to the song, Sowing the Seeds of Love is a Beatle-ish, psychedelia-infused, magical mystery tour of a song. Influenced by the work of Jean-Paul Sartre and Arthur Janov, Roland Orzabal says he wrote the song in the week of the general election in 1987, when Margaret Thatcher secured her third and final term as Prime Minister. Politician granny with your high ideals, have you no idea dear how the majority feels. So without love and a promised land, we're fools to the rules of a government plan. Kick out the style, bring back the jam. Clever line there. Well, he was wrong, of course, because the majority favoured a Conservative government. Amazing now to recall that one of the chief debating points between the party leaders in 87 was how the UK would react to being invaded by the Soviet Union. Amazing. That was only 25 years ago. And, of course, Mrs. Thatcher beat Mr. Kinnock and Mr. Steele and for her third term. Now, although Tears for Fears failed to bring down the Thatcher government, the song is one of the cheeriest and I think most sing-alongable protest songs of all time. So Tears for Fears, Sowing the Seeds of Love.
Yes, an interesting choice. I really like Tears for Fears, but this wouldn't have been my pick if I was going to pick one from them. Obviously, these things are entirely subjective. It's a little grandiose for me, and it's a little Beatlesy for me, and in a way, there were echoes of it when Oasis started to release stuff like All Around the World, which was just so Beatlesy as to be ridiculous, and you could tell that they had the budget in the studio to just, let's get an eighth string section in, And I felt, whilst Sowing the Seeds of Love is a much better song than All Around the World, I felt, in a way, it was a shame that Tears for Fears did have this enormous record company budget in order to embellish what they did, because I liked their sound when they were starting out, when they were a bit fresher and younger, were a bit more minimalist. And I really, really like a song called Pale Shelter, which I think was probably...
Oh, that was lovely.
Yeah, I think it was probably their first single, I think. But I do like Sowing the Seeds of Love, but I was surprised to see you pick that from the Tears for Fears oeuvre. And yeah, like you say, it was their most successful, most popular work at a time when they could hardly stand the sight of each other, and did they did record after that, but with no great acclaim. So they exploded at the top, really. The video is very 80s video, lots of animations and psychedelia and suns whirling round and things. A bit not dissimilar to the Sledgehammer video as well, I suppose, in many ways. But it is a good, and Tears for Fears always worth revisiting, because it's quite easy to dismiss them as a sort of also ran new romantic band, and they were much more interesting than that.
That's the point, is exactly that I tend to go back to them maybe once, maybe twice a year, and then I do a little Spotify compilation or iTunes compilation or whatever, and it intrigues me for about a week or so, and I sing along, and then I let them go for another few months. But no, Pale Shelter was an absolutely ace single from their first album. Yeah. Interestingly, released three times over 3 years, as they constantly tried to press it to the public.
Yeah, yeah. And you could do that then.
If
your debut song flops now, you're finished.
But, that's right. It reached 193.
Exactly.
That was this in the UK, in its first setting, and then got to number 5 the next year.
Yeah.
And damn it if they didn't release it again 2 years later, and it got to number 73 again.
You have to doff your cap to the A&R men who'd say, I believe in this song, and we'll keep pushing it until it hits, you just don't get that. This just doesn't happen in any shape, way or form now. So,
But they had a great run from 82 to 88, 89.
They really did.
And, as I say, worth revisiting from time to time. But yes, that's our picks.
Let me ask you this. What is the obvious link between Tears for Fears and Bobby Gillespie's outfit?
No, go on.
Well, Bobby Gillespie's band is Primal Scream. And
Arthur Janov.
Yeah, and Tears for Fears are named after Primal Scream therapy. They were great advocates of Primal Scream therapy. Very quickly, what it was the notion of going back to being a primitive man and sort of howling and crying and wailing and screaming to let all your insecurities out. So there's your little band link there. Yeah. Because originally Tears for Fears took themselves to the record companies with the band name Tears as a replacement for Fears.
Well, okay.
And some sharp A&R man said, well, that's fair enough, gentlemen, but I think we might just shorten that slightly. Because you couldn't really see a hit band called Tears as a replacement for Fears, could you? But yeah, they're a bit big. Yes, as you say, Janoff, Primal Scream Therapy. So a little bit of philosophy running through pop music there. And that should surely bring us to a close for the old podcasty this week. Thank you very much for all the information, opinion and erudition that you bring every week. Enjoyed your company. We will see you in 7 days' time. And as I always say, of course, there'll be no point in us sitting here venting our spleens if you didn't listen at home. So we're really glad of that. Whether you're listening on the moon, on the loo or on the run, we are very pleased to have you there and we thank you for it. See you in 7 days. Bye-bye.
Dacom Shore Media Production.